Moncrief on News Talk.
In this item, we will be talking about sexual violence, so it may not be suitable for some little ales and obviously very upsetting for some others. A trial concluded last week in which a man was sentenced to 7 years in prison for rape. The girl he raped was just 15 at the time. During the trial, the dress she wore was produced in court and she was asked if she had been wearing underwear. Rules have changed somewhat, but it still seems to be acceptable to imply that survivors of rape and sexual assault somehow brought it on themselves. This is something the solicitor Sarah Grace is all too familiar with. She's the author of Ash and Salt, From Survival to Empowerment After Sexual Assault. Sarah, good afternoon.
Nice to see you, Sean. How are things?
Not too bad. So tell us a bit about this case, because it happened some years ago and it took a long time to...
Yeah, exactly right. As it usually does, mind you. I think it took them about 4 years to get to court, if not more. But you're right. So it only concluded last week. And as you say, so, you know, 15-year-old girl at the time, now an adult, raped by 18-year-old man. And the facts of the cases they were reported on were just incredibly clear, but also horrifying. So maybe a bit of a trigger warning for, you know, people listening in the background. They were both at a house party. They didn't know each other personally. They knew of each other. He asked her to go upstairs with him and she said no. And later on in the evening, she went upstairs on her own to charge her phone. And he followed her up the stairs into a bedroom and started to kiss her. And his hands moved down her body and she realized things were escalating, I think were her words. And she asked him to stop, at which point he went to close the door and asked her if she wanted to have sex with him. And again, she said no, which is... there are no clear terms to indicate lack of consent, in my opinion. But he then pushed her back, pulled her bodysuit aside and raped her. As she repeatedly told him to stop, as she repeatedly said no and get off me and tried to physically push him away. But because of his, you know, kind of stronger build, she wasn't able to. And not only did he completely ignore her saying no, but in fact, he said to her, "I'm nearly finished." So he knew damn well what he was doing when he was doing it and that she was not consenting to this. So afterwards, you know, when she escaped that horrific ordeal, she, you know, ran away from the room, obviously in floods of tears, told her friends, and, you know, the case eventually made its way to trial. So, you know, horrific ordeal for that survivor and sending her nothing but the best, you know, thoughts and positive intentions. But really, from, you know, a legal perspective, there is no clearer cut case than this. You know, the words no and the words stop are the clearest signals of lack of consent, let alone the fact that they were said repeatedly and let alone the fact that she was resisting him physically as well. So it's really not rocket science to say she didn't consent. And yet the accused and the defense both tried to insist that she did consent. And what they used as evidence, as you said, is they produced her dress to the court and jury and kind of parading this around and asked her, was she wearing any underwear? And the fact that that was allowed to happen in what we call courts of justice, I find just completely, you know, unacceptable. And like, to me, like, in my opinion, the only reaction that is acceptable in this instance is outrage. And, you know, that we are now in 2026 and that this is not the first instance of this happening. And it's not just victim blaming, but we're really talking about humiliation here. In, you know, I'm a solicitor, so maybe a little bit biased, but I would have looked to our courts to be a place where we are held to the utmost standard of professionalism and dignity. And this type of behavior is so below that bar. And why that matters, you know, aside from the horrific ordeal that this poor girl went through, this case really goes to the heart of how we treat survivors of sexual assault in Irish sexual offences. And, you know, it perpetuates this culture of victim blaming, which we know from decades of research is wrong. And I'll get to that in a minute. But really, the issue is it deters survivors from going to justice. And we know now how difficult it is to report sexual offences. I know it very well because I've gone through it. I thought, you know, for my own case, and especially as a solicitor, I stupidly thought that I would maybe know a little bit more and be able to navigate the system. And I, a lawyer, felt blindsided, had no clear information given to me. did not understand what was going on, did not know who to turn to. So I can't even imagine someone who doesn't have that training. Mm. And
not to go on too much about your experience, Sarah, but yours was an instance where somebody, which is incredibly rare, should be pointed out, but somebody broke into your house.
Yeah, so...
But you seem to have been treated in a similar fashion.
Oh, of course. So, like, the all sexual offences, when they go to trial in Ireland, it is mandatory that the victim of the crime takes the stand and is cross-examined, because it's their testimony, basically, that forms the basis of the crime. But in the eyes of the law, they are not treated as a victim. They're treated as a witness, which means they are not afforded legal representation. So you're on your own and you're navigating really, again, in my opinion, sneakily crafted questions. And for my case, which was so clear cut, you know, and I don't mean that to imply that in many cases it's not clear cut, but they had nothing on me. I hadn't drank alcohol. You know, I went to bed at a reasonable time. My window had stupidly been left a little bit open on the safety lock, and a burglar broke in and assaulted me as I slept. But there was no question of consent. And yet some of the questions and the facts that were put to me were bordering on, well, did you really understand what was happening? And maybe that wasn't his intention. And how can it be that a man breaks into a woman's house at 3 a.m., climbs onto her bed and sexually assaults her, but it wasn't his intention to sexually assault her? So for any other, you know, because as you said, my case is so rare. For the vast majority of people, the perpetrator is known to you. It usually happens in a home, whether it's yours, there's a house party, an office, something like that. And then there's all these rape myths, basically, that are perpetuated that we know are not true, that say, depending on what the victim was wearing, or maybe they consumed alcohol, or how they were behaving, or their past sexual history, somehow implies that they are consenting to an act. And again, I think this case is the reason I'm so outraged. I mean, I'm outraged for every rape case I see, but this one in particular, again, the facts were so clear cut. And it feels like we are candidly wasting taxpayers' money, you know, spending time on trials that cost a lot of money. And every time a trial happens, there's hundreds of victims waiting in the backlogs, waiting for their turn. And that we are allowing this behavior to happen when really, you know, the crime has happened and the intention was very clear. Mm. I'm not trying in any way to take away from the accused's right to a fair trial or due process. I'm a lawyer. I get it. Many people get it. But victim blaming has no place in our courts of law. Is the point I'm saying.
Yeah, because I mean, I suppose you could see how in a percentage of cases, it's a kind of a he said, she said situation. But what she, how is what she's wearing relevant in any situation?
Exactly right. And I think what people forget a lot of the times as well, because you'll remember there was another case in, I think it was 2018 or 19, where again, the defense barrister referenced the rape victim's lace thong as an indication that she has somehow consented. She could have put that earlier in the morning for herself, for whatever reason. Maybe she did intend to have sex. But the thing with consent is you can withdraw it. You freely give it and you can freely withdraw it at any time. And again, that's not rocket science. Mm. And there seems to be this fear of, we are not going to be clear or understand when consent has been withdrawn or when it's not present. But in a case like this, I think it illustrates there's nothing to be afraid about. It is so clear cut. Any reasonable person would have understood at the first no, or at the very least at the second stop, that there was no consent. And this person, this man, decided to continue what he was doing, knowing full well what was happening.
Yeah. Do judges always allow that? I mean, underwear and dresses and that kind of thing.
So I wouldn't know, because the vast majority of the cases are in camera. So most people aren't allowed to step in. My understanding is it's very much a case by case basis. I have obviously, you know, I work a lot in this area. I've spoken to hundreds of survivors at this stage. I have heard horror stories. There are some judges that are very good at pushing back at that kind of behavior. But equally, there is such a culture amongst barristers, and again, this is my personal opinion, of aggressive posturing, of, you know, making comments that are really trying to destabilize the victim. And I am all for and understand you are trying to do your job, you are trying to, you know, get justice for your client and defend them to the best of your abilities. But to me, judges should be a lot stricter on slapping down that kind of behavior. And I have seen, you know, in a very different style, even in my case, you'll have, you know, sometimes barristers putting on quite aggressive posturing. And by that, I mean, maybe they'll put a foot up on the bench and start leaning into it and kind of, you know, spreading their legs. It's very aggressive when you, like, you have to imagine you are sitting in a room of 30 people, sometimes more, including the judge, the jury, the clerks, the audience, you know, the perpetrator, his family, your family. You're having to recount the most vulnerable, humiliating moment of your life. And, you know, in Ireland especially, we're not used to talking about sex, let alone consensually. Yeah. And having to recount that while someone is, you know, aggressively posturing or producing a dress that you wore or whatever it is, underwear, and implying that somehow you should be ashamed by this and this was your fault. Mm. It wasn't your fault. It was never your fault. You should be allowed to walk down the street naked. Maybe you'll be arrested for indecent exposure, but you certainly shouldn't be touched by anyone in a sexual manner.
Yeah. And but is there an argument for, say, banning the use of clothes in trials?
I absolutely think there should be. I cannot think of any possible reason. I literally cannot think of any scenario in which that would add to the evidence in any way. And let's not forget, Sean, that, you know, victims coming to trial, we see the trial when it's reported on. What you don't see and what victims go through, including myself, is all the obstacles and hoops you have to jump through before you get to trial. So believe you me, if there was not enough evidence to pursue this, it wouldn't go to trial. If the DPP has decided to pursue, in so many cases they don't because they can't and they know the case won't win on the basis of reasonable doubt, which is a very high threshold, a lot of the times it won't go through. So I cannot see what place any item of clothing, or for that matter, consumption of alcohol or whatever it is, has to do with the fact, with consent.
Yeah. Does that line of argument work, though, sometimes? They mustn't do it otherwise.
I'm sure it does, because, again, sadly, and, you know, I had never been cross-examined before. I don't know what I was expecting, but I was thrown. It's very aggressive. It's very confrontational. You're already feeling so vulnerable. You're already struggling to find your words. I mean, I cried through my entire examination and cross-examination. It was horrific. And again, it was open and shut case. There was nothing really to be questioned about, but it was still so difficult. It was the first time my parents were hearing it in detail. So I'm sure that it throws people. And I'm sure that then people maybe get defensive. And then again, that's a button that, you know, some defense barristers might start to press. And to me, that is below the belt. You can defend your client in good faith. You don't need to employ tactics to win.
Yeah.
I have heard barristers in the criminal courts of justice, you know, laud themselves and say, I've never lost a case. You should be losing cases. If your client is guilty, you should be losing cases. You should be getting them the fairest trial possible. But to kind of, you know, use these tactics to get criminals off, it's times like that where, like, as a solicitor, candidly, I'm ashamed to be a part of the legal industry.
In these situations where, as you pointed out, the person who's been raped or sexually assaulted is just a witness, what kind of supports are there for them?
There's very little supports. In fact, even, you know, people who are allowed to be there with you at your trial, the numbers are limited because, again, they don't want it to be unfair compared to how many numbers the accused might bring. So there's incredible organizations like, you know, frontline organizations like the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre and many, many others that are there to support, but they can't coach you, they can't counsel you, they certainly can't speak on your behalf. And a lot of the time, sadly, the information you're getting is wrong or it's inaccurate, or one person will say one thing, one person will say another thing, and it's really hard to get to the bottom line of what you're looking for. So again, you know, for anyone going through this, because I am always conscious of not putting people off seeking justice, in my book Ash and Salt, I've designed it as kind of a survivor's manual, and there's many, many chapters dedicated to the court system. And there's information in there that I hope you find helpful, that certainly I wish I had known, and I only found out after speaking to the guards who, you know, told me we couldn't tell you this at the time because it could have prejudiced the trial, et cetera, et cetera. I understand why, but I wish I'd been told that information. And likewise, speaking to other survivors, gathering all of that information, getting it into a manual for people and, you know, even support people going through it with you. So I was very lucky to have my amazing sister and my amazing cousins and aunt there. But, you know, we know from the statistics, 1 in 2 sexual assault survivors don't tell anyone.
Yeah.
And if they are going to court, they're going on their own.
Yeah.
And there are no supports. And it's so easy when you're in, you know, it makes good sense if you're in such a state of vulnerability and these people are in a position of power, it is normal to put your trust in them. And if the system calls itself justice, it is normal to hope and assume that you are going to get justice, but you're not getting justice in the courts, you're getting the law.
Can you tell us what it was you wish you had been told at the time?
Oh, there's so many things. I think the number one thing that I keep going back to for people is particularly you normally, you know, victims that are going through the court system will be given a family liaison officer who is from the guards. Mine was incredibly helpful. But, you know, obviously I had quite specific questions because I had a little sense of, you know, what was coming and he didn't always have the answers. So I always say to people like, do not be afraid to be a pain. I think it's a very Irish thing. And, you know, without being gender stereotypical, it's a very Irish woman thing to not want to make a fuss. Make the fuss. Send the emails. Put things in writing. Ask and ask again. Follow up. Be annoying in brackets. Certainly, I felt like I was pestering them. But it's the only way that you'll, you know, get that information and to lean on, you know, those organizations like the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. They are just incredible at helping you to navigate and remind you you're not alone. And it is never, ever your fault.
Yeah. But yeah, I suppose, and, you know, again, to reiterate your point, you none of us would want to discourage someone from entering the process. But you've had an appalling trauma. And then to a large extent, you're re-traumatized by this.
Yeah. And so exactly that. I think, you know, I would never discourage someone from going to justice. I knew in my gut. I think people know in their gut if they want to do it or not. But you have to go in eyes wide open. You have to know that the chances of this going through to the end and getting a satisfactory outcome, unfortunately, statistically, is unlikely. Even in cases where there is a guilty verdict, sometimes the sentencing then is so disappointing. So I think if you are going to go down that route, prepare yourself for that, like really prepare yourself for that, so that it doesn't come as such a shock if it does come and hopefully, you know, something better does come. But go in with eyes wide open. I always say, and I still stand by this, I found the court process more traumatizing than the assault, which is maddening to say. It's truly maddening to say. And I think what did it for me was, number one, how long it took, how prolonged things were, but also, again, this system and these people that are in these positions of power, and there's no one individual who is malicious or bad or, you know, negligent, but the system is designed with the accused in mind, and there's no room or very little room for the accused, for the victim or their family. So again, just being prepared for that and having the physical and mental stamina to go in there and being prepared for that, I think. Forewarned is forearmed.
And afterwards, whatever the result of that, how do you then get back to your normal life? That must be a slow one.
It's very
process.
Slow. Yeah, it is very slow. And, you know, I don't speak for all survivors. Like, every survivor's experience is so unique. But a pattern I do see a lot and that I certainly have gone through is there was no going back to my old life. So there was a period of mourning, actually, for the old Sarah in brackets and this new Sarah and this new life. I now am so happy with where I am. But it was a long journey of rebuilding. And I think, again, for each person, it'll look different. But I think it's going back to the basics of looking after your mind, looking after your body, you know, making those human connections where you can. There's another amazing organization that I work very closely with called Beyond Surviving. And that was set up by the formidable Kira Mangan, which is designed for once, exactly as you said, Sean, once the crisis has passed, there's this vacuum and there's this rebuilding and it's, no one, there's no role model or very few, and there's no one to tell you what to do. And so this organization that she has built helps survivors come into contact with each other, connect, feel re-empowered and slowly, you know, help rebuild their lives. And it's been amazing to be a part of. So highly recommend looking into that one as
well. Yeah. And I guess also not letting it define you. Even though it's something you can't forget about, of course.
But. Yeah, I think that's easier said than done. And again, every person will deal with it differently. But certainly it is not the only thing that defines you. And it's how you come out of it on the other side.
Yeah.
And I had heard a lady a few weeks ago say, you know, I like myself now and I didn't before. So I don't want to paint, you know, everything with a bad brush. There are beautiful things coming. And particularly to, you know, this lady who we've talked about today, I wish nothing but the best for her. I wish her a full life of, you know, healing and recovery. And I really believe that that is achievable.
Yeah. Sarah, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us today. The name of Sarah's book, by the way, is Ash and Salt. Excuse me. From Survival to Empowerment After Sexual Assault. Also, the 24-hour national helpline for the Rape Crisis Centre is 1800-778888. That was Sarah Grace, the solicitor you were listening to there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.